I'm Catherine Hedro. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, headed to Washington. World leaders gather for the NATO summit in the nation's capital. We have a preview of what's on the agenda. Closed-door meetings. Democrat lawmakers hold major discussions on the 2024 election and the future of President Biden. Fight for the unborn. Analysis of the Republican Party platform and what it says or does not say about abortion. And the next steps. The Vatican releases its goals for implementing some of the suggestions from the Synod on synodality. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Feast of the 120 Martyrs of China. I'm Catherine Hedro in for Tracy Sable. Our top story tonight. The Biden administration welcomes NATO leaders to Washington, D.C. The focus, Ukraine, and its ongoing battle with Russia. But for President Joe Biden, the NATO summit also represents a huge test. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Catherine, good evening. That test for the president you alluded to is to see if he can convince skeptical and nervous supporters he still has what it takes to continue as commander-in-chief for four more years if he wins in November.
The NATO summit arrives in Washington. Starting things off, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken calls on NATO to include more women. He says Ukrainian women have already stepped up to protect their country.
Right now, there are thousands of Ukrainian women who are serving on the front lines, literally as snipers, as machine gunners, as medevac pilots, commanding tank units and artillery batteries. Every day, they prove that valor has no gender.
Also speaking today, outgoing NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, who has said this week's focus will be on securing additional defense commitments and trying to get the war in Ukraine to an end.
This summit will be a summit where we celebrate the most successful alliance in history, but we're also going to make important decisions for the future.
And as the NATO summit unfolds, President Joe Biden tries to save his re-election campaign, which has been in a tailspin following that poor debate performance. He knows all eyes will be on him. And in the White House press briefing room today, ahead of the president's scheduled remarks to NATO, the press secretary telling reporters,
"We do want to turn the page. You heard me say this last week. We want to get to the other side of this. We want to continue doing the work, and that's what the president's going to do."
President Biden's health, a key issue for many voters going into November's election. Late Monday, Biden's physician issued his first comment since the debate. Dr. Kevin O'Connor tried to explain reports about a neurologist visiting the White House multiple times. He says the doctor was available to see a variety of patients and maintains President Biden has not seen a neurologist outside of his annual physical.
Now, tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday, the NATO summit really gets going. Work sessions, diplomacy, receptions, dinners, then a summit-ending news conference by President Biden. And one thing they're really talking about in this town right now is the heat. It is super hot. My phone today showing 105 degrees on the heat index at the White House. Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
For more on NATO and many other topics, I want to welcome former U.S. National Security Advisor and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. Ambassador, thanks for being here. What are the most immediate issues for NATO right now?
Well, I think NATO is obviously consumed at the moment by how to deal with the continuing Russian invasion of Ukraine, how to respond effectively or more effectively than it has already, and really what the long-term implications are. So there's a lot to discuss on that front, but obviously the 800-pound gorilla in the room is who's going to be the next American president. This is supposed to be, in addition to a substantive meeting of the heads of government of the NATO allies, the celebration of the 75th anniversary of the alliance, which really has been the most successful politico-military alliance in history, and yet concern about Joe Biden's condition, concern about the possibility of Donald Trump being elected in November are weighing on a lot of people's minds.
Last week, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization met in Kazakhstan. The 10 member countries led by Russia and China came to 25 agreements. Most of these countries have authoritarian governments. What does this signal to you?
Well, this is another piece of evidence of the growing China-Russia axis with various satellite countries involved in it. We obviously remember the Sino-Soviet alliance of the Cold War. This is very different because China is the senior partner, Russia is the junior partner. But it's another indication of adversaries of the U.S. and the West generally coordinating more closely and growing into something that I think really does represent a global threat to the U.S. and to our friends and allies around the world.
Ambassador, there's also the axis of resistance, a network of Iran-backed groups across the Middle East with the goal of reducing U.S. influence in the region. Have these alliances gotten stronger since the Israel-Hamas war, and do they pose a greater threat now to the U.S.?
I do think that Iran is one of the outriders of the China-Russia axis. China and Russia have different reasons to be supportive of Iran, but I think they see Iran as an instrument to help push the United States and the West generally out of the Middle East. I think Iran is operating through a network of terrorist proxies, the Houthis in Yemen, the Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Shia militia groups in Iraq and Syria, and obviously Iran's own very extensive military. Right now, the pressure they're putting is on Israel. That's what the Ring of Fire strategy was first designed for. But it really can also be used to pressure the oil-producing Arab governments of the Gulf and ultimately put pressure on the U.S. And others of our allies. So I view the what's happening in the Middle East now obviously immediately as a threat to Israel, but really as a threat to broader U.S. interests as well.
Speaking of the Israel-Hamas war, do you believe Israel can achieve its goal of eliminating Hamas?
Well, I think it can. I think it can eliminate the military capabilities. It can destroy the extraordinary network of tunnels that Hamas has built over many, many years, which would force it above ground if it ever came back. People say you can't defeat an idea, but, you know, in World War II, the United States and its allies did defeat Nazism, did defeat the militaristic authoritarian government in Japan that showed no signs of coming back. It's a hard job to do, but when you're faced with a terrorist threat like Israel, I can understand why it's not just the Israeli government that wants to destroy Hamas. It's really the overwhelming majority of the Israeli people is behind that.
And you can see part two of my interview with Ambassador Bolton tomorrow night right here on EWTN News Nightly. Anxiety and division about President Biden's future are front and center on Capitol Hill. House and Senate Democrats met in pivotal meetings for the first time since President Biden's faltering debate performance sparked concern. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us with developments from a very busy day on the Hill. Eric?
Hey, good to see you, Catherine. You know, each meeting lasted just over an hour, and there's still a lot of division and even avoidance by many of the Democrats. Many of them ducked the press corps all this afternoon, and after almost a dozen either publicly or privately said that the president needs to drop out of the race. One lawmaker described the meeting today earlier as if it was, quote, attending a funeral. But House and Senate leaderships emerged from today's meeting telling reporters that they are solidly behind President Biden. Three times Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer simply said this.
As I've said before, I'm with Joe. As I've said before, I'm with Joe. As I've said before, I'm with Joe.
But Senator Schumer, doesn't Thank you, everybody. Democrats-
Even Congressman Gerald Nadler, who wanted Biden out, reversed his view.
He is the person who's going to do it. He's going to be a nominee. Remember, only he can withdraw. He's made it very clear that he won't, and that's the end of the story.
The powerful congressional Black and Hispanic caucuses are behind the president running.
Joe Biden is. He's the president of the United States. I don't see that it, there's no one. I mean, he won the Democratic nomination. And as long as Joe Biden is running, Joe Biden is my candidate.
But some Democrats want Biden to speak directly to Congress and claim with the president's historically low approval rating and bad debate performance, there's no way he can win.
The debate cannot be unseen. The president has been running behind. We needed a surge. We got a setback. He is a great man who's made a great contribution to the country, but he shouldn't leave a legacy that endangers us that we surrender to a tyrant.
On the other side of the aisle,
the party that loves lecturing people about democracy is in a smoke-filled room trying to throw out the democratically chosen nominee for president by the Democrat voters. 14 million of them.
House Speaker Mike Johnson says he takes no pleasure in watching the commander-in-chief stumble.
I think this is a dangerous thing, a dangerous time for our country. It is not a good circumstance for us to have a commander-in-chief who is not on his A game, who can only work a few hours a day and can't answer questions or complete sentences. That's not a good look.
Again, Speaker Johnson says that the danger is very real and our adversaries are watching very closely. He adds, never before have we seen countries like China, Iran, Russia, North Korea, Venezuela, and even Cuba uniting together. One thing that they have in common, they oppose everything the United States stands for. Catherine?
Eric, time will tell if a change will take place. But switching gears, heavy hearts on the Hill after news broke about the death of former Senator James Inhofe.
That's correct. Yes, the Oklahoma's longest serving senator passed away today at the age of 89. He had come down with a sudden and unexpected illness around the 4th of July holiday. Now, James Inhofe started serving in Congress in Washington back in 1987 in the House of Representatives before being elected to the Senate in 1994. Our prayers and condolences go out to his wife, Kay, and his family. And he was always willing to give me his thoughts on a variety of topics in the halls of Congress. And I'd just like to thank him for that. Catherine?
We absolutely join our prayers. Thank you, Eric. Now to the war in the Middle East, where an Israeli strike killed a former bodyguard of the leader of Hezbollah. A Hezbollah official revealed the news hours after a drone strike near the Syria-Lebanon border. This comes amid repeated skirmishes between the Iran-backed militant group and Israel. Meanwhile, Hamas says that Israel's further involvement in Gaza could jeopardize ceasefire talks. Israel says the war will not be complete until Hamas is destroyed. The head of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church says the recent bombing of a children's hospital in Ukraine is a sin that cries out to heaven. In a statement, his Beatitude, Sviatoslav Shevchuk, says in part, quote, in the name of God, with all determination, we condemn this crime against humanity. The strike yesterday killed two adults and injured around 50 other people, seven of whom were children. The Kremlin denied responsibility for the attack, saying it does not attack civilian targets. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly, including the fight for the unborn. The Republican Party updates its platform on abortion. Hear how pro-life leaders are reacting. And jury selection begins in the trial of a well-known actor charged with involuntary manslaughter. Welcome back. After keeping a low profile for the last week, former President Trump will be back on the campaign trail tonight. He is holding a rally at his Doral Golf Resort. With the Republican National Convention right around the corner, many are wondering if he will announce his pick for vice president. Trump may also get a boost at the RNC. Today, former Republican challenger Nikki Haley has released her 97 delegates. It's a move that helps solidify GOP support for Trump. The 2024 Republican National Convention's platform has adopted new language on abortion. The platform, approved yesterday, removed a right-to-life provision and a call for a national law protecting unborn life. It also defended IVF, or in vitro fertilization, a practice the Catholic Church declares immoral. But the document praises the overturning of Roe v. Wade and says Republicans stand for families and life. It also emphasizes the role of states and fighting to end abortion. Here to discuss the GOP's updated stance on abortion and fertility health care is Dr. Ken Craycraft, the chair of moral theology at Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Cincinnati, Ohio. Ken, great to speak with you again. First off, your reaction to the 2024 GOP platform, specifically the remarks on abortion and late-term abortion.
Well, it's nice to be with you, Catherine. Thank you for having me back. Generally speaking, I'm disappointed with the platform. I'm disappointed with its tone in the first instance. I don't like the way that it sort of gloms onto the agenda or the language, I should say, of Donald Trump. I think there's some language in there that's problematic and aggressive and in a way that is off-putting. In terms of abortion, it's very disappointing because what the platform has done is that it has abandoned abortion as a moral issue and reduced it to merely a tactical political issue. And so what you have in this platform is not a strong statement of for the protection of unborn human life, but rather kicking the issue of abortion and the protection of unborn life to the states as a tactical political issue rather than a moral issue. And this is a sea change in the platform. And I think it's going to cause a lot of people who are on the pro-life side to have very serious questions about whether this platform is something that we can get behind and whether or not, therefore, this is a candidate or this is a party that really has pro-life interests in mind.
Ken, one of the big differences between Catholics and other denominations within the pro-life movement is the topic of IVF. The Catholic Church is clear IVF is immoral. That being said, how problematic is that new provision in this document, in your opinion?
Well, once again, we have a problem here because IVF, and it talks about IVF and it puts in parentheses fertility treatment. But of course, IVF is not fertility treatment. IVF is bypassing fertility. Obviously, it's a proposed solution to infertility, but it's not a fertility treatment. On the contrary, it's the creation of a human lives. And of course, every IVF procedure involves the destruction of unwanted embryos. So it's incoherent to say on the one hand that one is pro-life, but on the other hand it says one is perfectly fine with destroying embryos in the process of in vitro fertilization. So once again, we see the document has a lot of tensions that veer on contradictions and even incoherence. And this is one of those areas.
Why do you think, Ken, that the Republican Party is making these concessions after the arduous work of overturning Roe? And do you think it's turning its back on ardent pro-life members?
I think it's a tactical retreat, Catherine. I think that what has happened, we've seen states after states, including, unfortunately, my home state of Ohio, pass a legislation or a constitutional amendments that are very aggressively pro-abortion. And so the Republican Party apparently sees this as a losing issue on the national scale and therefore is downplaying abortion and downplaying the protection of human life, unborn human life, and its platform as a tactical retreat. I think this is a mistake, but I think that's what's going on. And therefore, by pushing it back to the states, the party is basically saying, let's fight it out at the state level and keep the federal government out of it. This is consistent with what President Trump has said, both in the debate and other places, where he's basically said, I wash my hands of the abortion issue. I appointed the Supreme Court justices in my first term that helped to overturn Roe v. Wade, and now I'm done with it, and I'll leave it to the states. And I think that's what the Republican Party is doing here.
Well, we appreciate your insight, Ken. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Jury selection starts in the involuntary manslaughter trial of Hollywood actor Alec Baldwin. If found guilty, he faces 18 months in prison and thousands of dollars in fines. This comes after the death of a worker on the film Rust in 2021. Baldwin has repeatedly said it was an accident, and he was unaware the gun contained live ammunition. The trial is likely to begin with opening statements tomorrow. While Beryl has moved out of Texas, millions are still dealing with the hurricane's aftermath. As you can see, neighborhoods look like waterways. Millions are still without power in sweltering heat. President Biden has approved a federal emergency disaster declaration for parts of Texas, which will offset the state cost of storm recovery efforts. Out west, record high temperatures in Oregon are believed to be what caused the death of four people. Another person died amid a heat wave in Death Valley, California. Yesterday, more than 146 million people in the U.S. were under heat alerts. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, Synod on Synodality. The Vatican releases the guiding document for the gathering this fall. We have a report from Rome and analysis from EWTN's Dr. Matthew Bunsen. greater participation of women in the church and more transparency. That's what a new guiding document for the upcoming Synod on Synodality in Rome suggests is ahead. EWTN Vatican journalist Paola Ariosa has more.
The Vatican has published a guiding document for the final part of the Synod on Synodality. The Instrumentum Laboris aims at answering the question how to be a synodal church in mission.
Per una chiesa sinodale.
It originates from reports from 108 bishops' conferences, 9 Oriental Catholic churches, as well as parish priests and other international ecclesial groups across the globe.
All these reports show a living church. They show movement, movements of the spirit, and a church on the move.
While the guiding document for the first session of the Synod last year covered controversial topics such as women's admission to the diaconate, priestly celibacy, and LGBTQ outreach, the new document focuses on other issues. It offers many concrete proposals, including the institution of a listening and accompaniment ministry, greater lay involvement in parish life, and more powerful parish councils. The document also gives ample space to reflection on the role of women in the church.
The contributions gathered from all phases of the synodal process highlighted the need to give fuller recognition to the charisms, vocation, and role of women in all areas of the life of the Church.
The document calls for a wider participation of women in all stages of decision-making processes, along with wider access to positions of responsibility in dioceses. Instrumentum Laboris also emphasizes the demand for transparency and accountability in and by the Church, which has come about because of financial scandals and abuses of minors and vulnerable persons in the Church. This is of utmost importance since the lack of transparency and accountability fuels clericalism.
Transparency and accountability are crucial, not just in matters of sexual and financial abuse, but in all areas, including pastoral planning and methods of evangelization. It also involves how the Church respects human dignity, such as the working conditions within its institutions, which is an important issue.
The newly released document will be the subject of prayer, conversation, and discernment by participants in the second session of the Synod of Bishops, to be held throughout the month of October in Rome. Its purpose is to offer guidance to the Pope. It can be expected that the October Assembly will also produce a final document that will be handed over to the Holy Father for possible exhortation. In Rome, Paola Riaza, EWTN News Nightly.
For analysis, we turn to Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director for EWTN News. Thanks for being here. Quickly, can you first clarify what is the role and importance of this document when the Synod reconvenes in Rome in October?
Every Synod has a working document, or it's a kind of tool. The word blueprint is often used for this. Essentially, it's what they will use as a guide for their labors in the next session for the Synod. This one is pretty different from the one that we saw just last year. We have to think of these as two parts of a whole. We had the instrumentum for last year in October of 2023 that was much more sprawling. It had worksheets. It was much longer. Mm-hmm. It touched on a lot of the hot button issues. This one is much more tight. It is very focused and shorter, too, to be sure. Mm-hmm. But it's a reflection, I think, of everything that has happened from the end of the last synod to this one. And dare one say that this is a project, in many ways, a reflection of synodality. They listened to what happened in that first session of the synod, and this one reflects that.
And adapted. To that point, this guiding document notably does not include, as you said, some of the controversial topics that were discussed during last year's gathering, such as women's admission to the diaconate. Yeah. What does that signal to you?
Well, it signals to me that, as I was just saying, there's a lot that happened from the end of the session. We were both in Rome for all of that, and the start of this new one coming in October. Mm-hmm. One of the most important aspects is the request, the mandate, basically, from Pope Francis to focus the discussions this October specifically on synodality in the life of the church, to set aside the hot-button issues that became very controversial and, in the eyes of many, slowed down some of the conversations, but also created an atmosphere of not acrimony, but of division in the Synod Hall. Pope Francis, to deal with those issues, created 10 study groups. And so we're seeing already a focus of this synod specifically on synodality, and the instrumentum reflects that, and I suspect that we'll be seeing that play out in the Synod Hall in October.
To put this all into context, looking ahead to October, that will mark the end of the discernment phase of this synodal process. And then what comes after that?
Yeah. There are three trains basically now in motion. The first one is the actual synod on synodality. We're going to have the conclusion of it, as you noted, the discernment phase in October. But then we also have the document that they're going to vote on, presumably at the end. This final report will be given to Pope Francis. He then has to decide what to do with that report. Typically, and this is the second train, he will write an apostolic exhortation, his reflection on the work of the synod. But then we have this third train that's in motion, and that is all of the study groups that are handling these big topics, the controversial topics that are not going to be touched in October. At some point, all three have to converge, and that's where things for the life of the church are going to be very interesting, and that's where the implementation phase sets in. So, yes, this is going to end in October for the Synod on Synodality, but synodality in the life of the church is just getting underway.
And like you said, we'll continue to monitor and report every step of that way, including in October in Rome. Matthew Bunsen, thank you for your time.
Great to be with you.
Thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Catherine Hadro. Good night, and God bless.